Hello, Calyxers. Welcome back to Sight Unseen, Sunday mornings, 9 to 10 a.m., talking about art and its reflection of and upon life. My name is Tani Katenjian, and I'm your host. This week, an interview with two artists, Abe Burickson and Matthew Perdon, talking about their most recent project called Locating the Borderlands. These are two local artists. You may not have heard of them, or you may have. Their event is quite special, and they'll be explaining that to you later in the show. You'll just have to stay tuned to hear about that experience. Also, stay tuned for art events from Naomi Cancella and music, mainly brought to us from England. Not music from England, but picked by an Englishman. So all that and more coming your way on Sight Unseen. Stay with us. This is a listing of art events in and around the Bay Area, beginning this Wednesday, the 1st of June, and running through the 29th of June. The Pacific Film Archive presents Recovered Memory, a series featuring Bay Area underground features from the 70s. According to the PFA's Steve Side, these films are unnerving and political, whimsical and steamy. Wow. They throw out superfluous stories and masterful acting as readily as they throw in dancing turtles and flammable bras. They are wily in the ways of cinema, yet indifferent to the menace of budgets and box office. They are part of a codependent cinema, one that relies on a crazy lust for movie making on the part of the artist and an equal lunacy for adventure on the part of the viewer. You can catch these feature films from the 70s community of underground filmmakers from the Bay Area beginning this Wednesday at the PFA, and that's in Berkeley. For more information, visit www.bampfa.berkeley.edu. If you're not in the mood to revisit the 70s, you might be in the mood to visit the PFA on Thursday, the 2nd, for a free first Thursday screening at 5:30 of Goodbye, Dragon Inn, the Taiwanese favorite from last year's San Francisco International Film Festival. It's part of the PFA series A Theater Near You, a collection of recent releases that we may have read about and look forward to seeing, yet never make it to Berkeley before going to DVD. The PFA has been screening these films because they won't be seen any other place near you. Rain, misconnections, and loneliness intersect against the backdrop of a martial arts film. It's a rainy night in Taipei. The crumbling neighborhood movie theater is showing King Hu's swordplay classic, Dragon Inn. Most of the audience appears to be elsewhere, off-screen dreamers haltingly putting their thoughts of love into very slow motion against the backdrop of on-screen frenetic swordplay fury, which is always exciting. Free tickets are available at the PFA Theater starting at 4:30. Again, bampfa.berkeley.edu is the place to visit, or call 510-642-0808 for more information. Across the street, this year's Master of Fine Arts graduate exhibit just opened at the Berkeley Art Museum. If you're curious about what's been developing in the Fine Art Department here at UC Berkeley, you have until June 19th to visit the Berkeley Art Museum to get an idea of what this year's crop of Master of Fine Arts graduates have been up to. The 35th Annual University of California Berkeley MFA Graduate Exhibition features video, sound works, installation art, and paintings from this year's five artists to watch. Visit bampfa.berkeley.edu again for more information on this event. In San Francisco, the Roxy Theater is screening Doing Time, Doing Vipassana, the award-winning documentary about Kiran Bedi, the dedicated inspector general of prisons in India, who, in the mid-1990s, introduced the ancient technique of Vipassana meditation, quite literally the oldest form of Buddhist meditation, into the violently corrupt Tihar Prison, India's worst and most dangerously overcrowded prison at the time. The results at Tihar Prison were almost unimaginably miraculous. After the 10-day course in Vipassana, which requires total silence and the willingness to go deep inside oneself, violent criminals were transformed, emerging with tears of joy and open hearts. Now Tihar has its own meditation center, and penal institutions around the world are following its model. Similar programs are already being implemented in prisons in the UK, Spain, New Zealand, Taiwan, Thailand, and even the US. Actually, even here in Northern California. We have only now through Friday the 3rd to see this documentary at the Roxy Theater, 3117 16th Street in San Francisco. That's Roxy 415-863-1087, or visit roxy.com for more information. And finally, the San Francisco International Arts Festival is underway and running through Sunday, June 5th. SFIAF 2005 includes artists from more than 10 countries and presents over 30 visual and performing arts events featuring groundbreaking artistic work from Russia, Germany, the UK, France, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, Canada, and the Netherlands, the Republic of Ireland, and even our very own San Francisco Bay Area. Highlights include a rare Bay Area appearance by Japan's Mansaku no Kai Company with their Kyogen version of A Comedy of Errors, and award-winning artists from the Edinburgh Festival, including Doe Theater of St. Petersburg, Russia, and Fabric Company of Germany. Events take place at Dance Mission, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Palace of Fine Arts, Arto Theater, and ODC. Call 415-399-9554 or visit sfintlartsfest.org for schedule and venues. And that's all for the art event brought to you every week from Naomi Cancella on Sight Unseen on KALX Berkeley. A few years ago, Matthew Perdon and Abe Burickson were both in a writer's workshop. And as these sorts of things happen in workshops, they start talking about something that is of profound interest to them both, art, and in this specific case, audience. Who is audience? And for whom is audience created? They came up with an idea that instead of making art for a large audience, what would it be like for a group of artists to create a piece for an audience of one? They picked one person, learned everything about this person's life, and in a 24-hour art extravaganza, a group of artists created numerous pieces based on all the minute details they had learned about this person. They presented this work to just him, for just him, and in doing so, reevaluated the idea behind audience, and even behind creation. Furthermore, they made art an experience, an interactive, multimedia, momentary experience. Now Abe and Matthew have created a new piece called Locating the Borderlands. If you look up Crossing the Borderlands on ye olde internet, you might come across this. Artists don't think, they do. And what we perceive is a representation of that process. This is especially so when we explore the work of the transmediators, those artists and writers who cross the borders of their discipline and draw influences from the flux of explorative action. In their work, they not only reveal to us their representation of life, but more importantly, they lay open their creative method. Indeed, the method is frequently pushed to the fore. Transmediation forces us to engage as a participant in the creative act, not merely respond as an observer or consumer of the completed artifact. Transmediated art thus becomes intersubjective in its intention and effect, always establishing the third mind. Okay, that might sound a bit complicated and a little, well, out there, but it is an apt reference to what Abe and Matthew are attempting to do. They're attempting to make art an experience, something you do, an observation of process, a unifier, an exploration into what is real and what is fabricated, and an understanding of how fine that line is. There were over 30 artists involved, 9 participants, and 1 narrative. Well, 1 offered narrative, a narrative left to the participants' own interpretation. I spoke with Abe and Matthew the day after their event. Here, they describe exactly what happened on that day.
The project is called Locating the Borderlands. The group that we're sort of working with, a sort of loose collaboration of ours, is Odyssey Works. So it's about, you know, creating these journey-like structures where you become the protagonist in an immersive environment that's responsive to you. Basically, it starts with a card. A postcard. You could have been handed it by an artist, a friend, and on the front of the card it said, "Are you?" and an arrow, and then you turn it over, alive, and had some boxes there. And so it was sort of a little like line, and you had to figure out, do you check the box closer to alive or not alive? Then you put your name, address, and you mail it off to the Borderlands headquarters for a travel visa.
No other explanation.
So you made this postcard, and you sent it out or handed it to people, and they essentially had to distinguish whether they were how alive are they in their lives?
Okay. Right. And then once we received those, we sent back the visa sort of request form that had a couple questions. Why do you want to go through the borderlands? Tell us a little bit about yourself and attach a photo if you'd like. And we got all these in. I think we also emailed them just to say we received your thing and all this and wait for a response. And after we got them in, and we sort of went through, and then we had the team who had been working creating the project look through them and try to select them to get a wide range of people. So we had someone as young as 18 and old as in their 50s, you know, from all sort of walks of life. And so that range of people we're sort of testing to see, could they all go on the same program, go on this sort of narrative journey, but yet come out with a different story? Because we don't, even though we construct this, the only place it lives in is in the really in the moment, I'll say in the ephemeral moment, but it's really only in those stories that they constructed as they went through it. So their start of their day was they arrived at noon at the intake office, where they were issued a passport, sort of our own sort of playful way to ask what your emotional baggage was, if you had any spiritual vaccinations. We had their thumbprint taken, their photo taken. We asked what their intentions were, recorded that on video. And then they were sent along the way. Well, they all arrived at, not all, but in groups. So I was also playing a backpacker sort of character, but I was just really like one of them, just dressed like as a hiker. And I pretended to be one of the participants who had gotten one of these cards. And I got to quiz them throughout their waiting time in the waiting room about what their experience were, and sort of meet each of the participants at that time before they went into the customs. Once they came out of customs, they immediately went down the stairs where they encountered Abe, who was...
I was their travel guide. I was going to take them right through the borderlands to capital city, right? And I was telling them how wonderful. I gave them a pamphlet about the lodge that they'll stay in. You know, something's a little off about this place. And you know, I'm telling them that the borderlands is a pretty uncertain place, and capital city, everything is very controlled and very clean and safe. And started setting up the story of this place that they were trying to get to, and trying to give it, you know, a little bit of this quality of control and certainty as opposed to uncertainty. And you know, so we're on our way, and we're about to, you know, we're going to go to the train station, and you know, you don't have a reservation. Oh, we got to run in and make a reservation. So we ran into a bar, and I said, can I use the phone? They, you know, grab the phone and dial the number. I give it to them, please make a reservation. They get a reservation line. I take off, ditch them. All right. So then they're in the bar, amnesia. And you know, there's an old drunk in the bar, and he starts talking to them, having some random stuff. And the bartender says, "Oh, you know, you got ditched by your guide. Oh, well, you know, you have this pamphlet. I know who made that map. You need to go to the map maker, right? You know." So he gives them the map maker's card, and the person heads off to the map maker. And the map maker is this character who lives in the borderlands, right? They're starting to get into the borderlands, which I didn't want them to do. I, the travel guide, and the map maker. You know, he's never been outside his office. He doesn't know anything, but he's the map maker. And he's got all these wild maps, and this kind of alchemical sort of map overlay process happens with San Francisco map and the city, you know, capital city map and the old San Francisco map when there was the lagoon and all this stuff. And, you know, a sort of an idea of sort of overlaid realities on top of where they're going to give them a sense that, you know, San Francisco is now the borderlands, right? And they get sort of sent out along their way, but of course they don't go where the map says, because they immediately get snatched up by a you know, a courier who's going to take them there. But instead of taking them there, he has to take them to this place where this thing is going on, because they've got this, you know, this orb, right? This Quan Ding transmitter orb, right?
And I just want to say something about the orb, which is that the orb actually arrived with one of the participants' visa applications. He had sent us about 20, 25 bouncy rubber balls that glowed in the dark. So just from that sort of interaction, that level of participation, that's sort of one reason why we thought, well, we'll pick him. I mean, they weren't all wild as him, but in picking him. But then he's like, okay, he made this initiation to play. We'll play with his balls, and we'll incorporate them into the piece. And that's how the orb ended up.
Right. So I'm assuming that the person in amnesia knew that he was going to be involved. The map maker knew that he was going to be involved. So the person in amnesia had been guided to send this group onto this map maker.
Yes. And every 20 minutes they're coming in, right? And so we're going through the same thing every 20 minutes, right?
It's a staggered event. Right, so it's not nine people journeying together as a group. They're journeying individually. So every 20 minutes, they move from the location to location in a staggered way.
So they, nine people doing this on their own, individually.
Yeah.
So they have no idea where they're going to be going. You didn't tell them anything. They're just going on a journey, a narrative that you prepared for them.
Exactly. So this first part that we talked about is all high narrative, and people are talking, you know, in the process, people are talking about Capital City and telling these strange stories, some of them poetic, some of them strange, some of them, you know, just nothing, right? But, you know, they're getting into the borderlands, and it's a very kind of narrative thing, right? So they've got the Quan Ding transmitter orb, which, you know, you can tell by looking at the pamphlet that you got from the travel guide is probably from the Quan Ding Monastery. Who knows what that is? And later we hear about the Quan Ding masters who turn their bodies into gold, right? And, you know, the driver takes it, oh, well, you know, you've got one of these transmitter orbs. Well, I have to take you, you know, where it tells me to go, give it to me. And he drives them off, you know, and to this next scene after tossing the ball out the window. And and in this next scene, there's a complete drop of the narrative, right? Again, we've just gotten them revved up, you know, to think that this is going to be a big story, right? And the next scene is this very simple thing. They get brought in. They get a stethoscope machine transmitter put on them. This house begins to beat with their heartbeat. And they go in, and they start to follow their... It's silent, you know, there's no other sounds, just their heartbeat on... just sort of coming out of these speakers around the room, and they're just left alone in there. And there's somebody controlling this whole thing. And then these other heartbeats are brought in, and they're brought down, and this old person's heartbeat is there, and they're just left to do this. And some people, and we don't have the full stories yet, but some people were sort of, you know, were just like, wow, you know, just exploring it. And other people were looking desperately to find out what part of the story this was, and there's that tension there. And then they're blindfolded and allowed to follow their heartbeat some more and brought into this other room where these dancers, these wonderful contact improvisation dancers, would start dancing with them blindfolded, dancers with non-dancers. And just the most beautiful things resulted. Some people would give their weight, some people wouldn't, some people, you know, it was very interesting for them, and they'd done a lot of rehearsal with non-dancers. And then they would take them, and they had them blindfolded, sort of tap out on a typewriter, some keys, and then they would leave the room and unblindfold them, leave them alone with this typewriter, and they'd see that they'd tapped out, "Do I Know You Now?" on the typewriter. And then they were left with the typewriter alone in this room to type out whatever they wanted, right? And eventually they're taken out and sort of sent along their way. And then they're back in story, right? You know, these stilt walkers come along and they're spouting poetry, call and response poetry, and, you know, sort of accompanying them to where this kind of strange tea party is happening. And there's these kids, their children, some children of the people working on this piece. And the children come up, they've been told to ask, you know, some deep questions, right? So they ask, you know, what's the meaning of life? And, you know, why, you know, I don't actually know all the questions the children ask, but I know they asked that one.
Mm-hmm. So were these people, were they still alone at this point?
They would occasionally be some overlap where they might encounter one of the other participants who was in front or behind them. And we really don't know what those encounters were about because we weren't planning that, you know. And I think that the sort of side conversations that help them to metabolize the experiences they just had and sort of process it. It's not about keeping them always going from experience to experience, even though it's sort of like we're talking about. There's times where there's downtimes or you're walking from one location to the other location on the streets in the Mission of San Francisco, and you might be encountering other people, which happened a couple times. One guy went to the wrong address. We had name tags on them, so they sort of, you know, when they arrived, people knew who they were. And the guy just went up and said, "Oh, hey," and, you know, said their name and started talking to them, and they thought it was part of the piece. And it wasn't until a half hour later, when they were sort of standing in this place, they realized they're in the wrong place and something's going wrong. They looked at the address and realized that it was the same address but the wrong street. It was the same number but the wrong street. So they had to go over to the right thing. We had another participant who stumbled across a landlord protest right next to eviction protest right next to where he was supposed to go, and he thought, well, it's this big happening, it must be it, so I'm going to go in. So he goes in the apartment where the landlord was, who had just evicted these people or whatever, and called the cops. And so he was detained by the cops for an hour, trying to tell them, like, what's really going on. This is the guy who was dressed as a clown. So, you know, the landlord was like, what's this freak protester doing in my place?
He didn't know that he was still thinking even the cops, because they're wearing cloth badges and not metal badges, right? He's thinking that even they are in on it, right? You know, he thinks we said that. You know, there's this whole thing set up, you know, where anything could be in on it, and anything is, in a way. That's sort of a key, yeah, right?
Yeah, we don't deny that that's not part of the piece. I mean, it may sound like we have no control in it, but, you know, I mean, it's sort of, why do we have to have complete control? You know, I mean, it allows that seepage to come in to the piece from the real world. So it's not, you know, so many times you hear about immersive experiences and you're in a movie theater where the lights go down, we all lose our identity. Here, your identity is right there with you. And the interesting thing is, I believe he was, same person was also earlier ticketed by a cop somewhere else, yeah, before he was trying to arrive. So he was late by an hour arriving. So it already happened in real life before the piece, and then happened in the piece. So there's no, you know, the boundary, you know, and that's why the piece is called Locating the Borderlands. Where do you find yourself in the border zones of life and art, your identity and your soul? And where is the connection happening? And I guess we should get back to the piece and sort of the continuation of the story a bit. Yeah. Unless you have a question.
Well, I do have a question. It sounds like it's kind of, so you're messed with these people's realities then.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, yes, there's a trickster aspect to this. But I think in the best way, in the same sense that, you know, sort of, you can think about the Native American coyote and shaman figures as tricksters. I think it's the trickster to wake you up to what's really your life is, because we get caught in these habitual patterns and we fall asleep. And so it's not just a trick. There's a lot of reality TV going on, you know, where people are making people do stupid stuff and tricking them and ha-ha, and we all sit there and spectate in front of our TV making fun of people and some of the most grotesque things. We're doing this, I think, with some real intention of, I guess, value behind it.
Which is to wake people up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, definitely to wake people up.
And to create something that will make them see. And I think that's where we get back to questions of what art is, because for me, in a way, you know, there's what beauty is in a way. For me, I think beauty is anything that makes you see it. And if you create a beautiful piece of art, you really see that thing and you see it again and again and again. And if we can work with that seeing, that's enough for me.
I think the seeing that I'm most interested in, particularly as a performer, is the sort of seeing that happens in the inner subjective experience. When do two people enter into this boundary and see each other? You know, right? We don't lose ourselves one for the other, but we're both standing there looking at each other. And as from our pure subjectivity of people. And that's sort of the beauty. That's where beauty is for me.
Now you're followed the heartbeat, the dancing, mm-hmm, the stilt walkers, right, all of which knew, they all knew exactly what was going on.
Everybody's got the script. They've got their lines, you know, they're on, you know, it's a story, it's theater, it's dance, it's all that stuff, right? And then they're taken out again, right? They're taken out. Somebody says, oh, you're not in the next piece. There's been a screw up. You're not in the next piece. Will you just come and have a drink with me? You know, two men and two women did this. And they begin to flirt with the person, start to work. And it's very interesting how they were doing this. I spent a lot of time working this out. And they begin to flirt with the person. One person's flirting with them. They don't notice anyone else. Another person chatting, discussing, whatever, trying to really rise to that occasion with whomever they were with, right? And that goes on for a little while, and then they say, oh, you know, I've got to go do something. I got to go get the car, you know, bring it around, whatever. And then this other person who's been trying to make eye contact comes and kisses them, saying nothing, and leaves, right? And they're left alone. And then they get a phone call later. You know, I mean, but first they're left alone with that experience, totally outside the story. This is supposed to be, you know, some people in the project, but then this thing happens, like, whoa, you know, that happened in real life, you know, in your regular day. And, you know, maybe it happens to people sometimes. In fact, I know it happened to somebody I knew just the other day, that they randomly just got a kiss from somebody randomly on the street, and you're just, wow, you know, what was that? And working, you know, sort of raising this question of desire, which fits in various ways, but then they get a call, right? Doctor, you're needed at the hospital. you know, come quick, here's the address. And we've got these wonderful locations from Red Ink Studios, huge office spaces, massive spaces. And there's this whole mental asylum set up. You know, so they run down there and they go to the mental asylum and it's just silly, you know, people are nuts. There's nap time, craft time, you know, what were the other times? Group time and what? Medicine time, yes. And so they're all doing this thing, and, you know, there's a bunch of people in there, and they're all kind of, you know, in rehearsals, they began to kind of bring up their own sort of pathologies, which was quite interesting. Let me just say one thing. You know, there's a Slobodan Pajic, who's the head of the Artship Foundation. When I first met him, he said, you know, art and theater, it's really about the tension with somebody's, with working with their own pathology. And that always really, that resonated with me. And in that scene, there is that. But it's a fun scene. It's ridiculous. They've got silly videos playing. Everybody's kind of running around doing crazy stuff. People get a chance to kind of get crazy. And they're the doctor. And then a few minutes later, and the nurse walks up to him, and that's nice, you know. Can you take the doctor's coat off now? You know, that's, oh, you're playing doctor now. Come on, it's not. Suddenly they're the patient.
So this is sort of begins to switch in the sense that with that switch from them being the doctor, being in control, it sort of highlights those moments where we're trying to release our identity, to break out of it. And right the moment before you break, you have those intense resistances where you're trying to control it. So by confronting them in a space where they're given the high status power role where they're supposed to be in control, but in this chaotic environment that they can't control, and then stripped by it, it's sort of mirroring that experience. And then they're invited to let go, to play, to let out their pathology, become one of the patients. And then they escape from the asylum. The asylum is run by the agency. It's where they put the people who can't function in the controlled environment of Center City, where they've been trying to get to.
You'll notice the name of the city keeps changing. I want to say Capital City, Center City, Bridge City, whatever. I just want to interject that because it's important, because the city is in a way a projection of this kind of crystallized, frozen way of seeing things.
And so now they're escaped from the asylum, and they're sort of escaped from the last holding place, where the buffer zone of the Center City people, and back into stuff that's out of story. And now it's the deeper story we're weaving. So there's that sort of initial story, but this deeper story of you breaking out of the surface level story to the understory of becoming what we say is a border person. So they go into the dream environment. Tomoko Murakami, Liz Sklar, and the Dream Theater people did this piece where they're confronted with a camera. They ask them, which is projecting their own image of the participant on the screen, says, is this you? Who are you? And we'd collected dreams and nightmares from them. So they did these sort of participatory dance pieces improvisationally with the actual material from these dreams of their own subconscious. And I know from reports so far that some of these were extremely, you know, sort of expurgative motive experiences for some of these people at this point in the day, because now they're in this dream reality already. At the end of it, they're given a card and says, you're now a shadow unto this world. Those who can bring you back are here. And so it's sort of this death experience of the death of your identity, the death of all these sort of construct, everything's boring, and can you be sort of reborn in that sort of soul space? And they go into a sequence where they're into a room that's, they go down the street to this other room that's totally covered with white sheets, and there's a huge pyramid. There's a projection of beautiful light going on. There's beautiful music. First it's dark, actually. It's dark, and there's confessions, and there's beautiful, this whisper, and I'm confessing sounds. And it's that sort of the confessions, that letting go of stuff. Yeah, beautiful sound art in darkness. Then it lights up into the white space and the pyramid structure that they go into for this purification ritual using water, and there's some feet bathing, and these women dressed in white. And then they're let out, and now we're sort of saying, you're now stripped your identity, you're connecting to your sort of soul level at this point. And they go down the street where they then suddenly they walk past someone, there's just sort of clap. And another person claps, and then they come, and there's this huge building, this huge, the old Mint in San Francisco, and the people on the steps, and a bunch, this crowd of people applaud them.
Just like that. I mean, it's just so interesting, right? I mean, Mary Anderson and a whole bunch of people spent months rehearsing this. You know, just What is the effect of that? What happens when you're just applauded for no apparent reason? You're just sitting there. You know, we thought, well, you know, if a stranger is walking down the street and they're suddenly applauded, they might get really self-conscious, might feel bad. Actually, I should do this time and time again. And people, these timid people, gregarious people, all of them, they would light up. There's something in the reaction to applause. I don't know if it's cultural. I don't know if it's inborn. I don't know if it's the attention. But it just lights people up. It's so fascinating. It's one of these things we didn't know.
And we rehearsed all these pieces. And one of the things we were trying to rehearse was, it's not just like come like, oh, hey, applaud, you know, like you're at some big sporting event. But you're like trying to like applaud, see the person, applaud from your deepest place to them. So it's a real heartfelt sort of applause. So what they're seeing and being applauded for is their deeper self is what we're trying to sort of energetically do. But at this moment, someone immediately comes. We're back into the first story. Someone pulls them away. This guy who's trying to help them. He's like a Borderlands person, but he's saying the agency's after you. You've broken out of the story. You're in danger. They're going to try to grab you back into the story. And he whisks them away down to Yerba Buena Gardens, which is set as a safe haven.
And it's dangerous for the applause to happen like that, yeah, right? Because the agents will see you and they'll get you and they'll know that you're, you know, definitely a border person, right?
And now you're in the safe zone and you get dinner. You're given a box. There's a guy there with an old Victrola radio player just churning away, playing music for you. You get this box, has your name on it. You open up, all this beautiful food. And a little card that says, please take your time. You can relax here. And then you have an appointment with the tea maker at 7 o'clock. That's you know, whatever your time was for the people. Now the
BART card was in there.
And the BART card to write in the BART, the full instructions. The interesting thing here is a whole bunch of things begin to crystallize here. Earlier they'd received in the children at the tea party in the garden, they received some tea. Here in the box with the BART card and the card with the tea maker, they have a bag. So they know, okay, the tea maker, hopefully they put it together. And they get these instructions. So after they eat and relax, they come around on to BART and then follow these instructions and leads them right back to the same house where the map maker was. They probably realized it about when they turned the block and are like just, you know, two doors down from the house. So they went from, now they're back here about 7 hours later where they visit the map maker to see the tea maker, and they've gotten these tea supplies. They walk up the steps. The steps are covered in rose petals. The door actually opens by this handle. Like it's like they don't have to step down. Like they pull this old Victorian handle thing, or Edwardian probably, and pops the door open, and they come up, and there's a guy in a kimono greets him. He's the same assistant that the map maker had. And they might say, you know, I've seen you before. And he would say, well, I have a new assistant now. I have a new master now.
And what did the card say?
The card said, here's the appointment. It's 7 p.m. It's time for the master's tea. What's interesting is most people think, ooh, now I get to have tea with the master. But on the front it said the tea maker, right? Something about serving. And what's so funny is they come in to see the tea maker. The assistant leads them in down a path. There's all these roses, sets them in a room where there's some pillows. There's rice spread all around on the outer skirts with candles. There's incense and more rose petals. And they're closed. Assistant goes away. And they're just alone in this room with a boiling kettle. And that's like a sound piece, the pure sound boiling and the steam coming up. A minute later, the door opens. This opens the door, and there comes the tea maker to make them tea. And as soon as they see him, they go, oh, are you the master? And he responds, you know, something like, I'm delighted you think me. It is I who am honored to serve you. Now, the thing is, I'm playing the tea maker. And I was the backpacker before. Some of them, to this time, we're pretty sure, didn't realize that I'm actually the same person, because earlier I had different costume and a beard. I had shaved during the day. So we had transformed the room. I had transformed as a performer, and energetically I was in a much different space. I'd meditated before. I'd been fasting all day, which in the beginning was like the hungry backpacker guy. Now I'm like, you know, spiritual fast, right? So I hadn't eaten anything for close to 20 hours by now, and I was in the zone. You know, I was looking, there was like scratches on the wall, and I looked at them, they were like Zen marks. It was like beauty. I was like, anyway, so I came in and made them tea this ritual way. I actually studied Japanese tea ceremony for 4 years. I didn't want this to be a culturally specific thing, so I sort of did this improvisatory thing. And we just were sat alone in this room. and had some more meditative experiences. Some were joyful and beautiful. Sometimes we just stared at each other, and it's like each one of them, I met them in some deep, deep place. And this is where we go back to Henry's piece in terms of you're talking about there's the person and there's the identity. In this moment, I was there myself as the performer, as the creator of the performance, as a performer in the piece, as myself with my own history and my own deep connection to my own soul. And some of these connections I had this with these people in this private little room was them with their identity, their story of who they had seen me before, who I had become, as well as their soul, their structure. And I mean, one conversation in particular, like I saw exactly where he was, like he was aware of we were in both places together. It was that true, deep, intersubjective experience.
In terms of these questions of their identity, right? Because they got their identity as the protagonist, and they have their own identity as who they are, right? And then there's just these experiences. But at that time, right, they were still in the story of the Borderlands to a certain extent,
right.
Which is quite interesting. Even though it was this direct thing, it's the master. Now, who's the master? They're the master, right? So they've got this identity which has been built up in the Borderlands. It's still a narrative. It's still a story, right? But it's also this direct thing, and then that gets changed later. That gets broken down again.
Right. It's sort of going from the story of the external identity story to the soul story, but it's still like how do you even break out of that story? You know, it's like another level of it. So after the tea thing, they leave, and they're given the instruction by the assistant to go where you were picked up last time, where the curry was. This time, though, they get kidnapped. They're now back in the original story. The agency has caught them and eventually captures three of them together. Like they're like the first one's captured, driven around. Then they come and capture another one. They rough them up a bit. Boom, come around, get the third one, blindfold them, and take them to the final destination, which is sort of the climax of the event. After having this deep sort of intersubjective real experience, but still partially the story. And some people still probably thought, you know, probably weren't sure who was the master and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. Some people were still asking questions. It was real tricky. But anyway, now they're back to the climactic final experience. So they're blindfolded. They're opened up. The kidnappers take them out of the truck into
this holding area, which is this kind of industrial room. They don't know where they are. They're blindfolded. They hear somebody welding in the background. Right? These guards are, you know, they're sort of walking them in, and then there's a changing of the guard, and somebody else comes in, and he's like, he's on the inside, right? He's on their side, but he's on the inside. And, you know, he says, you know, he gives them some information that, you know, that there's going to be a pretty rough tribunal that's about to happen, and I'm on your side. There's only one way to break the system. There's only one way to defeat these guys, and that is when they ask you to tell them the story of how you got across the Borderlands, because now they're right on the border. They're right on the border of Capital City. How you got across the Borderlands, don't respond. Do not tell them. And that's what he tells them. He's like, all right, get ready. And this is, of course, at cell space, right? So they have that big back area there where they're held, and they can kind of hear some ruckus in the other room. Right, and then the doors open, and they're brought into another room, and they hear applause, and they hear the band, and then they hear the host come out, and there's a game show about to happen, and they're brought out blindfolded on stage and introduced as tonight's contestants, right? And so there they are, blindfolded on stage, being introduced, and their blindfolds are each taken off. They've been blindfolded for a while now. And their blindfolds are taken off as they're introduced with a little bit of the information that we gathered from them from their applications. And there's three of them on stage, and there's the host, Judge Dr. Doc, and Vanilla Wright, who's Vanna White, and Dr. Abacus, the band who's, you know, playing all the stuff. And the whole nine yards, and the place is packed, and there's a cheerleader who's got the cue cards, and all the audience knows, you know, that, you know, what we're up to. They're citizens of Capital City. They're there to vet these people to see if they're really are insurgent elements, antisocial people, those who are sort of not fit for life in Capital City, right? And Judge Dr. Doc is the host, right? And he's up there, and that's Henry Rosenthal from our previous piece. And so he's up there, and he's playing this character, and this guy loves Capital City, right? And it's a quiz show. It's kind of like Jeopardy. you know, and they've got, you know, four categories of questions, and there are commercials before. But of course, the questions are totally absurd, you know.
So it's a total Dada event. There's two rounds, two cameras shoot with the video, everything being projected like a TV show, until it gets to the final round, at which point there's three final questions. First two questions are quick questions, one being why, the sort of standard philosophical question.
Another one is, was it brillig today, and when will the gimbling abandon the waves? Stuff like that, you know, right?
And then the final question, that third question, finally comes, which is,
tell us the story of how you got across the borderlands. And this was tense for us.
And we rouse the audience up until they're chanting, tell us, tell us, tell us, tell us.
And remember, they're coming from this really sort of meditative place, right? Into this place where they're standing up there, the lights are in their face, 100 people are screaming, tell us, tell us, tell us. Right? It's intense.
And when they were given the microphone, we hope they remain silent. Which, for the most part, they did.
Well, they didn't tell us. They responded. Some said, you'll have to find out for yourself. Right. One person just dropped on the floor and started coughing. Another, you know, people would fake their own death. You know, they got theatrical, right?
But they didn't tell us the story. At which point, the entire thing freezes. The audience freezes. The band freezes. The judge doctor freezes. Vanilla Wright freezes. Everybody freezes. It's like the entire story mechanism breaks down and freezes. And then just an older man, white hair, gets up from the audience, walks up onto the stage, greets them, asks them to come with him, leads them in, takes them out the back door, sort of just connects with them in a real present moment, just as people, no story, opens the door, ushers them out, closes the door.
Done.
Done.
Done. And that was it. And then we got the next three in. And then we got the next three in. And everybody did it.
And so I mean, sort of, we haven't had, I mean, this was just yesterday. We haven't had time to get much information yet. But what we have sort of gathered is there are people who, we've gotten some emails from the participants just of their own accord. And I've heard some stuff via phone. One guy, I believe, is still confused. Not sure what he went through. Mm-hmm. Very disoriented. Took him forever to reconnect with his wife, I think, after the event. We had another participant who's still asking us to see if they got the story right. You know, to see, did I get to Capital City? Or what would have happened if this, right? And then we have this one. I just want to sort of read from this email here. This was the person we were most worried about, saying before. She'd emailed and said, this is like about 2 days before the event, 3 days before the event. I'm considering bailing out of this whole Borderlands thing. I'm being asked to devote from noon to midnight to this trip, which I know nothing about. I'm very curious about, and I'd like to know what it's all about. And she goes on for about two pages. All right? Now, after the end, after the thing, she emails this and says, in hindsight, I'd like to compare it to how it could be that one only knows one has been bitten by a mosquito once it is already over and the venom is already injected. While it's happening, you don't feel it at all. You think you can tell, but the mosquito senses you more than you sense it, and it's a give-and-take relationship. I was happy to be one of your hosts, one of your guinea pigs, one of your few to participate. It's a nice dose of purposeful purposelessness. And I'm sure as the day, week, year progress, more and more insights will settle into my being. It was a wonderful trip through. Thanks. Just what I needed. I hope I give back as much as I receive.
So she was very fearful at first. Mm-hmm. She still has fear, obviously, but seems to think that this will affect her. And well, you definitely, since the whole point essentially is to wake someone up or change their perspective or move them in some way, you definitely accomplished that.
Yeah, I mean, before we ever started all these things, I remember saying, I said, you know, if I can write a poem that was really just fully received by one person, just one person, if I knew that what I was trying to get across came to one person, that would be enough. So now we have eight, right? Now we have eight, and we're going to see what happens.
Yeah, and I mean, meanwhile, we continue to do our traditional art too, which is interesting. I think I've had the painting that's, you know, someone has seen, or a performance where someone's seen that's been connected. I think you've had your poetry connect. But yet we continue to come back this to its sort of most primary thing, just human interaction and this core idea of experience. And so, blurring that boundary between art and life and, you know, the audience and the artist. And that boundary is where the things exist, and that's why we did Locating the Borderlands, and hopefully we'll be doing a new experiment soon.
So, and blurring the lines between what we perceive to be real and what we perceive to be what we don't know is real.
Yeah, I think that sort of there's sort of the ordinary world we normally live in, these hyper-real worlds that we construct in our fantasies, and that even art has to do with, and the tension between those two occasionally can pop us into the real, real world that's underneath it all, that we're always trying to see, because it's always there. It's just, can we see it or not?
Well, let me ask you this then. As artists, what's your kind of ultimate hope that art can, that art will do, that art can do, regardless of whether it's poetry or painting or sound or dance or, you know, whatever, improv or theater, whatever it may be, what is the ultimate hope that it can do?
I mean, for me, you know, there's something about art which becomes an object, whatever it is, becomes an actual thing that can make itself seen, and by making itself seen, it makes life seen. And you go back to that art holding a mirror up to life, and you start to think that it's in there somewhere, and making our lives actually noticed, and thereby valuable. That it's the answer, I think, is somewhere in there for me.
Those were the voices of Abe Burickson and Matthew Perdon. For more information on their projects, please visit www.odysseyworks.org. That's odysseyworks.org.
Thank you. jagged jigsaw pieces tossed about the room. I saw my grandma sleeping with her old straw broom. She didn't know what she was doing. She could hardly understand. That she was really sleeping up pieces of a man. Saw my daddy meet the mailman, and I heard the mailman say, now don't you take this letter too hard now, Jimmy. They've laid off nine others today. But he didn't know he was saying, he could hardly understand. That he was only talking to pieces of a man. I saw the thunder and heard the lightning and felt the burden of his shame. And for some unknown reason, he never turned my way. Pieces of that letter were tossed about the room, and now I hear the sound of sirens come knifing through the gloom. But they don't know what they are doing. They could hardly understand. That they're only arresting pieces of a man. I saw him go to pieces. I saw him go to pieces. He was always such a good man. He was always such a strong, strong man. Yeah, I saw him go to pieces. I saw him go to pieces.
Thank you to Sight Unseeners Naomi Cancella, Lee Montgomery, and William Smith, and all those who make Sight Unseen somehow get on the air. This is Sight Unseen on KALX Berkeley. My name is Tanya Katanjian. Have a great week.